Good evening, everyone. It gives me great pleasure to host and chair this event today. My name is Tomila Lankina. I'm a professor here at LSE in the International Relations Department, and I'm delighted to present a talk by Maria Zolkina, who is an expert on Ukraine and an expert that we are extremely lucky to have with us as a DINAM fellow at the International Relations Department at LSE. Maria is a researcher and political analyst. She works in the fields of regional security, reintegration policies in occupied territories, and wartime diplomacy. And especially since the start of the war in 2014, she's been working on studying public opinion in the occupied territories in the Donbas and pioneering and piloting original and innovative, in terms of their design, surveys. And she's been also associated with the regional security and conflict studies at one of the most authoritative Ukrainian think tanks, the Ilko Kucherev Democratic Initiatives Foundation, and she's authored many policy papers. She's given, I'm sure many of you have seen Maria on international news channels and outlets, from BBC to Al Jazeera, where she also worked before joining us at our department. So we are extremely lucky to have to hear her insights from her research in the Donbas. And we're also very pleased to have Dr. Florian Voss, who is Associate Professor in Political Behavior at the Department of Government here at LSE. And he's got ample expertise to have a dialogue and discussion with Maria about her research, because in his work, he studies political campaigns and he's used randomized field experiments trying to identify the causal effects of formal and informal interactions between citizens, politicians, and campaign workers on electoral mobilization, opinion change, and political activism. So Maria will speak for about 20 minutes, after which she and Florian will have a short Q&A discussion, and then we will open it up to a wider Q&A. So the floor is yours, Maria.
Thank you, Tomila. I hope it's working, right? My mic.
I'm going to
change.
Well.
Yeah, I'm going to change a place for the time when I will be delivering a lecture. Thank you for presenting myself, Tomila. Just a couple of additional words about myself, because I'm originally from the very east of Ukraine, from Luhansk region, which is now 95% of which is now occupied by Russia, but it was not always like that. Before 2014, two-thirds of the region were under the Ukraine. After 2014, after the beginning of the war, hybrid war in Donbas, Ukraine still controlled two-thirds of the region. And my family house was basically on the very front line on government, on Ukraine government controlled part of Luhansk region. And it was for 8 years like that, being the front line area, unless the full-fledged invasion started. So today, I'm going to challenge the main myths and narratives which have been spread by Russia about the region since 2014. This is how Russia is trying to persuade, and to a certain extent, after 2014, they have succeeded with that, to persuade the whole world that there was some kind of a breakaway region where the overwhelming majority in 2014 wanted to secede from Ukraine. And that now, in the light of large-scale invasion of Russia, a lot still have an impression, and you can always feel it within their different discussions with experts or politicians or ordinary people who are just interested in politics, that there is no sense in even thinking about returning Donbas, occupied after 2014, occupied after 22, under Ukraine's control. And I'm going to challenge all these main myths, which with data, with evidence. The think tank which Tomila has mentioned while representing myself is Democratic Initiatives Foundation, which is really one of the oldest, founded in 1992, think tanks in Ukraine, which is famous in Ukraine and abroad for including public opinion research conducted in different forms into the public policy research. So almost all the data which I'm going to present today was prepared, was found out, was in the framework of qualitative and quantitative research of public opinion, studies prepared by myself and colleagues at DIF and several organizations which we are partnering. So let's start from here. Myth number one, which is really very widespread around the world and around Europe as well, is that Donbas was a breakaway region which really wanted to separate from Ukraine in 2014, which if you have a look at the data of what was gathered in spring 2014 and later, was completely not true. At the beginning of so-called Russian spring in 2014, as Russia called the developments of hybrid warfare in Donbas, in March 2014, in one of the polls which we conducted there, which is representative for the entire Donetsk and Luhansk region at that time, 90% said that they consider Ukraine to be their homeland, which no way differed from the average perception of Ukraine as their homeland on average in any other Ukrainian region. Moreover, a little bit later in April, our partners from Kyiv International Institute of Sociology, probably the biggest sociological company in Ukraine, which is also famous for their reliable research, they conducted another poll, and they found out that at that time, 72% of people in Donetsk region, a little bit less in Luhansk region, were against the developments of seizing and capturing the administrative buildings, which already happened in both regional centers, in Donetsk and in Luhansk. Some people who claimed themselves to be local activists, but somehow were having weapons and were very aggressive, they captured their regional administration building in Donetsk and their building of security service in Luhansk. And this was the turning point, basically, when they didn't meet any reaction on the authorities. Everyone was afraid to make in some radical to contribute to escalation. But this is how the hybrid warfare in Donbas started. And moreover, our public opinion polls and various studies in spring 2014, representative for the entire region, showed that none of the so to say separate or secession scenarios for the region have never had support from overwhelming or even relative majority of the citizens in that part of the country. This is one of the examples. We asked people trying to find out whether they have any sympathy to any separatist scenarios. It is the end of March, the very hot period. People without insignia, but with weapons and with Ihor Hirkin as their leadership, the FSB officer in Donetsk region, were already occupying a number of towns. But we measured that there was, for instance, only 18% of those who think that secession of either Donetsk region or Luhansk region was a desirable scenario for them. The same only 18% was answering yes to the idea that southeastern regions in Ukraine should establish their own state. By this, we tested actually the scenario of so-called Novorossiya, which was very core of the Russian invasion in a hybrid way, but nevertheless, at that time in Donbas, Russia was speaking about the entire south and east of Ukraine and tried to organize the same self-proclaimed republics, not only in Donetsk and Luhansk, but also in Kharkiv, Odessa, in Kherson. But everywhere it failed, except for Donetsk and Luhansk city. The highest share of the people who somehow considered some separatist scenario were people who said that they were thinking about southern or eastern regions of Ukraine joining Russia. But nevertheless, it was only 26% of them. And never before the real warfare started in Donbas in the middle of 2014, we have the share which would exceed that. So basically, the real data showed that, yes, there were some people on the ground who really supported some kind of separatist scenario, but they constituted absolute majority. And the problem at that time, that minority was aggressive and was very visible, and basically was used as a shield for the undeclared warfare on the side of Ukrainian neighbor Russia. Myth number two, which is also very well rooted in informational space since 2014, is that Donbas was some kind of a monolith, some region which was very monolithic in terms of how people feel. Russia, even widespread idea of people of Donbas having their own history, while being even a separate ethnic group or national group. There were different variations on the side of Russian propaganda at that time. But basically, it was not true at all. Even Donetsk and then Luhansk together, or not together, but basically one region and the second one, they were very different when it comes to finding out what people thought, which language in which parts of the regions they spoke, Russian or Ukrainian, how they felt in terms of social-political identity. So never Donetsk and Luhansk region constituted a separate from the rest of Ukraine socio-economic, ethnic, religious, or even political community, because even these two regions were always very diverse inside. And after number of cities, both in Donetsk Oblast and in Luhansk Oblast, were occupied for several months in 2014 by Russian forces without insignia, led by already mentioned Igor Girkin. After that, several months before the number of cities were liberated and brought back under the control of Ukraine, we actually went to the field and conducted four representative public opinion polls in four different cities, two which were under the occupation in Donetsk region and were liberated. These were Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. They are still controlled by Ukraine, and Russia is still aiming at destroying the cities and capturing them. Two of them were in Luhansk region and also were occupied and then liberated. It was in 2014, I remind you. But now these territories are occupied, Severodonetsk and Starobilsk in Luhansk region. And we found out basically that, for instance, in Donetsk region, Kramatorsk and Slavyansk, two towns, actually cities, pretty large, very close one to another, maybe 10, 15 minutes drive maximum, were simultaneously under the control of Igor Girkin and his people, were liberated at the same time, but showed a little bit different perceptions of the situation. Kramatorsk, for instance, proved to be much more radical in terms of their pro-Ukrainian sentiments and identity. They were denying the idea of peace at any price with Russia. Only 23% in Kramatorsk said after occupation that they would agree to anything regardless of what is proposed just to end the conflict, while in Slavyansk, people were more ready to any kind of compromises at that time. The same situation was in Luhansk region. So in one city, people felt more frustrated about the general situation, undecided. In other city, in Starobilsk, for instance, people were more ready for compromising. You don't need to go into that probably specifically like what people are thinking. The main idea here is that there was never one kind of general community which can be called Donbas, because even inside both oblasts, you always find the diversity when it comes to political, socio-political perceptions and perceptions of the conflict. This is basically the borders of Luhansk and Donetsk region in 20. This is the map from February 2015, when basically the front line appeared a bit more or less stable, and it looked like that until 2022. I will try to use this laser. I don't know if it shows something. Basically, this with stripes, so this territory was occupied. Blue and yellow, this was part of Donetsk and Luhansk region, which were under the control of Ukraine after the beginning of the war in 2014 and before 2022. So only one third of the territories bordering directly with Russia was occupied by Russia in 2014. And that is where those occupation administration actually functioned before 2022. So this is, again, to understand that it was not the entire region which was under Russia's control. And that's why, even by the way, in the constitutions of so-called Donetsk People's Republic and Luhansk People's Republic, it was stated that they claim for the territory of the entire Donetsk and Luhansk region, and Ukraine occupies those territories. So, and 8 years after that, Russia actually used this as a precondition to declare their military, as they say, support to self-proclaimed republics in order to invade that part, which was that part of the region, which was controlled by Ukraine. But regardless of the diversity, there were several trends which were really uniting the region. One of them was national identity, which means that when it comes to socio-political identification, people started feeling themselves first and foremost citizens of Ukraine rather than feeling representatives of the region or residents of their settlements. And the second trend, which was uniting both Donetsk and Luhansk region after 2014, was common vision that Donbas should be under the control of Ukraine and not separately, not within Russia. This is numbers from 2014, like the very hot period of May and then of July. And you can see basically that in May, for instance, the main main share of the population, relative majority, felt themselves first and foremost representatives of their region. And nationwide socio-political identity was only on the second place, twice less than the share of people who felt themselves first and foremost representatives of Donbas. And this started changing already 2 months after May. Why? Namely, because on May 11th, so-called DPR, Donetsk People's Republic, and LPR, Luhansk People's Republic, conducted so-called referenda and declared their independence. And that was the turning moment when the real warfare started and the real process of reintegration or attempts to reintegrate the territories which were not under the control of Ukraine started. This photo was made by Anton Skiba. This is a very famous photo, which actually was everywhere in spring 2014. This was made on 5th of March 2014 in Donetsk, when people, local citizens in Donbas, started protesting against any aggressive mass rallies demanding any separation from Ukraine. This is how real Donetsk looked like. And unfortunately, because of the weapons, because of attacks and aggression, a lot of these people were on next meetings were beaten, some of them died. And basically at the end of April, it was not possible to do any with Ukrainian flags at all because of aggression Ukrainian meeting look like when people felt the first threat to some kind of violent scenario in the region. And this is 2020, when we see that the national identity, nationwide identity, when people first and foremost in terms of socio-political identification felt themselves to be citizens of Ukraine rather than representatives of their local community or their region, it was dominating both in Donetsk Oblast and in Luhansk Oblast. This is one of the long-term trends which took place. And the political future of the entire Donbas, including territories which were not under the Ukraine control from 2014, this is also something which was uniting the residents of both Donetsk and Luhansk region. For instance, you should draw attention to orange and yellow columns, which are showing the number of the people, the percentage share of the people who were in four cities, which I mentioned before, four cities in Donetsk and in Luhansk region, in favor of the Donbas political future inside Ukraine, with more autonomy, with more rights, or without, like on pre-war conditions, but nevertheless inside Ukraine. And this also one of those numbers proving that. The myth number three, which Russia was really very successful in pushing forward, is that Russia was never a party in the conflict. Russia was never a party in the conflict, but was rather a mediator between, as they claimed, Donetsk People's Republic and LPR on the one hand, and Ukraine on the other hand. There were two main formats where negotiations were taking place. One, and the most important, was Normandy 4. Normandy format started in spring 2014, and it included Ukraine, Russia, and mediation from Germany and France. This was the top level of diplomatic framework. It has several sub-layers, because when leaders of the state met, then basically the work was going further on the lower level, like between, there was a ministerial level, then the level of political directors at the Ministries for Foreign Affairs, and the level of political advisors, which became the most active one. For instance, when President Zelensky became a president of Ukraine, and his head of his office, Andriy Yermak, became the representative of Ukraine as a political advisor to respective level of Normandy format. But there was no LPR, DPR, or anyone else from occupational administration in this format. They were not presented there in any way. The second layer, or the second format, which was established upon the decision of the Normandy 4, was Minsk Trilateral Contact Group. And again, it was composed of Ukraine, Russia, and official mediation from Special Monitoring Mission of OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. None of the separatist administrations have ever been represented anywhere and be a party of any negotiations in none of the format. So the main documents were on the basis of which the negotiations were the two Minsk accords. And I will not stop here a lot, but we can speak about it later if you're interested in how diplomacy worked between 2014 and 22 and why it failed. But on one of the Minsk, on those Minsk documents signed there, on some of them, really appeared the signatures of people without status, without posts, without even mentioning what they were doing there, just name and surname. And those people claim, on the basis of their signatures in the documents, that they are representing the self-proclaimed republics in Donetsk and in Luhansk city. But in fact, it didn't change anything at all, because representatives of self-proclaimed republics have never had their own place in any negotiation format. And when they come to Minsk to participate in Minsk Trilateral Contact Group, they always were members of the Russian delegation, regardless of all their propaganda and informational support to this very idea. And people on the ground as well, even in 2014, didn't see Russia as a mediator, but saw it rather as a party of the conflict. For instance, those four cities which I mentioned previously, right after they were liberated, Severodonetsk, 52% said that there was a war between Ukraine and Russian Federation, not a civil conflict, not a conflict between central authorities and local authorities. And this tendency actually only strengthened. The longer conflict dragged on, the more determined people living on government-controlled areas of Donbas were about the role of Russia. In particular, very important was that in 2020, by 2020 actually, for instance, in Donetsk region, we fixed radicalization of the public opinion on the ground. People considered, 76% of the people on the ground considered Russia to be a party of the conflict, defined the situation as the war between two states, and were not ready to compromise at any price. So at the beginning, they were more ready to that. They were more in favor of negotiations and a lot of concessions. But by 2020, in the Donetsk region, there were left only 14% among local population who were ready for Ukraine to compromise at any price. And the myth number four, the last but not the least, is something which is based on all the previous myths and narratives, that if this region is breakaway and separatist, if people didn't like being inside Ukraine as a part of Ukraine, then why, Russia says, should this region be returned under the control of Ukraine? And a lot really doubt that, that reintegration of the region is possible. I state that reintegration is possible, and it will, of course, demand a certain long-lasting transition period, like after any interstate armed conflict. But we cannot say what is the real picture of the public moods in occupied territories exactly, because classical methods of studying public opinion there are not working. Yes, probably you can go there, send interviewers, and gather the data which some of the companies, including Western pretty reliable think tanks, did actually. But all the sociologists have an agreement, working in the conflict studies, have an agreement that when there are extraordinary circumstances, you can gather the data, but you can really doubt the validity of the data. It can be gathered properly, but it will not reflect the real public moods on the ground. So let's not speculate that people on those territories are entirely pro-Russian and they do not want any reintegration, because simply we don't have any data proving this assumption. Second point here, we still can try to measure and find out what people think there, and we did that, at least between before 2022, when we tried to measure public opinion through polling people on the checkpoints, organizing interviews with those who lived on occupied territories or with their relatives. And this is incredible picture, incredible screen, I would say. But you should point an attention to basically the number of 52 million times. After 2014 and before 2022, 52 million times, this is the number of crossing of the division line which existed between occupied territories of Ukraine at that time and government-controlled territories of Ukraine. This basically proves how actively people living in occupied territories tried to keep their connection, their horizontal links with their relatives, friends, their links with the state of Ukraine by using administrative services and coming to government-controlled territories to receive administrative services from Ukraine. This is incredible number of crossing on average. In a month, it was around 300,000 crossing every month before the COVID, when Russia, using the COVID reason, almost completely blocked the moving. From the Ukrainian side, checkpoints were pretty soon after the breakout of COVID were open, but after 2019, the number of people crossing was artificially restricted from the other side, and it significantly decreased the connections. And when we asked people on those checkpoints and polled them there, we found out, for instance, in 2019, that 60% of those who were crossing the checkpoints considered themselves to be citizens of Ukraine. And only 3% of them said that they feel themselves, in terms of their social political identity, the citizens of Russia or the citizens of self-proclaimed republics. This picture, which is this is Stanitsa Luhansk. This is my hometown, and this is part of the checkpoint, which was the only one checkpoint serving in Luhansk Oblast after 2014. It was the most busy one. We also tried to organize some qualitative research of people living in occupied territories between 2014 and 2022, because we tried to ask either their relatives and friends about what they know about the experience of their friends and relatives living there in occupied territories, or we talked to people living in occupied territories directly. And there was no one trend of being pro-Russian in terms of political future of the region or being pro-independence in terms of supporting self-proclaimed republics. The public opinion in terms of qualitative research proved to be much more divided than someone would expect. Some people didn't want reintegration with Ukraine. Some people aimed at that specifically. Some agreed that reintegration is possible, acceptable, expected, but they would need to find a different time when something will change on the side of Ukraine. And someone was simply tired of the conflict and stopped thinking about reintegration options because of that. In 2021, 1 year before the large-scale invasion in February of 2021, there were only 20% of the population who crossed the division line, who were keeping the connections with Ukraine, who said that reintegration of Donbas with Ukraine was not possible at all. The absolute majority mentioned that it is possible and it will happen, but it will demand something 5 to 7 years, something longer perspective. Some were very much optimistic and expected the reintegration in 1-2 years, but unfortunately in 1 year from that poll timeline, we had not the reintegration of Donbas with Ukraine, but rather a large-scale invasion of Russia. And people were also, when it comes to people in living constantly in occupied territories and people who were crossing the division line. So we again fixed the trend that there were no overwhelming adherence to the idea that there should be the break complete and full with Ukraine, and people were still thinking about reintegration at some point. Here I come to the conclusion point. Sorry, I was a bit longer, Tamila, than I promised. So first and foremost, the myth of separatists is still alive, but fortunately to Ukraine, after Russia openly occupied parts of the other regions, namely Kherson region and Zaporizhia region, exactly for the perception of all of the occupied territories, something has significantly changed. Because as of now, there is no big difference between when and how the territories were occupied. Now Russia officially declared the annexation of a number of the regions, including Ukraine. And this is completely illogical politically and diplomatically for Ukraine and for its partners to divide between territories who were occupied previously and which were occupied in 2022. Second important point is that 80% of the population in government-controlled areas had the personal connection to those who lived in occupied territories after 2014, and those people were always keeping those connections alive and trying to save those connections as a precondition for reintegration at some point. The situation with full blockade of the checkpoints for a long period of time after the COVID breakout, this blockade was on the side of occupied territories when they stopped allowing people living there to cross the line and come to government-controlled areas of Donbas. It also proved in the one of the public opinion polls that personal experience matters. And when people see something which they experience personally, like blockade, lack of possibility to use the service, lack of possibility to be allowed to enter, to leave the territories. They didn't believe the Russian propaganda about the restrictions, about the Ukraine's role in this blockade, because they felt on their own experience that this blockade is from the Russia's occupied part. And this also gives a good example of when you have a different informational sources, or when you have a personal experience of the people seeing with their own eyes what's going on, you have some kind of a precondition to overcome obstacles created by long-term occupation. And the last but not the least is that in 2022, when Russia occupied a number of cities in Luhansk and occupied several important cities in the Donetsk region like Bakhmut, several days ago Avdiivka, this is one very important point to remember. Russia basically occupied ghost cities, empty cities. For instance, in Severodonetsk, after the warfare started in 2022, almost the entire population, 90%, have fled the city. It was 128,000 population there before the beginning of the large-scale invasion. And when Russia invaded the city in 2014, after the long-term devastating strikings on the city, there were around 10,000-11,000 of the population. So 90% have fled. And that's why when you see a picture of somebody in the now occupied territories claiming that everyone is here pro-Russian, I always keep in mind how many really population is there. Probably they are now pro-Russian, but they never constituted, right, they don't constitute more than 10% in case of Severodonetsk of pre-war population. 10%, the same applies to Popasna. Bakhmut is empty, the same is Avdiivka. Here I end that part of our presentation, of my presentation, and we will, after a couple of talks with a couple of questions with Florian, we will go back to discussion with you. I'm very much looking forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Maria. This is very, very thought-provoking. I wanted to give Florian a few minutes to maybe respond with some comments or some questions about methodology, maybe survey design, or other questions before we open it up to the Q&A.
Thank you very much, Tomila, and thanks for this insightful talk, Maria. As you said, I mean, I come to this question as somebody who studies opinion change and public opinion, mostly in the UK and in Western Europe, so you might think that I'm a bit of an odd choice as a discussant. I have some personal experience in the sense that I lived in Ukraine, in Kyiv, for like 6 months, from April to October 2021, so just before the full-scale invasion, which was definitely a steep learning curve for me. I think that also included facing some misconceptions, you know, that often Western Europeans, when we come to Ukraine, still hold. One of those actually was, and you didn't really talk about it much in your presentation, was really related to the role of the Russian language, right? Mm-hmm. In structuring identities in Ukraine, but also in structuring political preferences and attitudes. And I do think that there is still this kind of relatively persistent myth out there, right? I mean, that these regions and Donbas is very much kind of divided alongside this kind of, you know, language-based based identities. Of course, we know, say, from work done by Ola Onuch and Henry Hale, that, you know, there's been this kind of rise of the civic identity in Ukraine also as a response to the war. But I just wanted you to talk a little bit more about kind of what the role of language is. So mm-hmm. If you were to break down some of those tables by whether people speak as a first language Russian or Ukrainian, mm-hmm. How would that look like?
Yeah, I actually even forgot how frequently this question was asked to us previously, so I probably should include this, but we really had a data on that. We were curious ourselves, me and my colleagues, back in 2014, 2015, when everything was very, very much intensively developing, whether the language actually impacted the political perceptions of the people of what was or should be happening with or in Donbas. And we found that not. There was no difference whether people spoke Ukrainian or Russian when it comes to thoughts about political future of the region. So both those who were speaking Russian wanted political future of the Donbas inside Ukraine as people who spoke Ukrainian. So it really didn't affect their political perception of what should happen to the region in the future. Moreover, the situation in the cities, for instance, which I mentioned in my presentation, was also very was demonstrating this kind of, for instance, like Luhansk region, two-thirds of the region which was still under the control of Ukraine after 2014, was very rural area in comparison to Donetsk region. So by this, you really find a difference. When you go in Donbas, when you go to the town, most probably you will find local people speaking Russian or some kind of Russian and Ukrainian together. But when you go to villages and other generally rural areas, especially in my home oblast in Luhansk region, you will find really Ukrainian citizens living in the village, I mean, speaking Ukrainian. Ukrainian language was very much widespread there. And that's why basically the percentage of Russian-speaking population, according to the polls, was higher, significantly higher, like up to two-thirds. In some towns or parts of both Donetsk and Luhansk region, even more than two-thirds. But it really didn't affect it. Actually, it proved the contrary, that while being Russian-speaking, people still considered, like I said, 90% considered Ukraine to be their homeland, didn't want peace at any price, didn't want concessions, considered it was the war. So basically, it was not a division line within the Ukrainian society. But in 2022, situation really started when Russia invaded Ukraine on a large scale. This is when actually language started something became something which matters in terms of self-identification. Before 2022, it was on the average level, both around in the country and in the general, and in Donbas in particular, it was not something predefining your political views.
That's interesting. I mean, I agree, right? I mean, when I came to Kyiv, I was actually surprised by how much Russian was spoken in the city, right? I mean, if you would go to a restaurant, and because I'm an obvious foreigner, or not Ukrainian, I guess, to some extent, because I don't speak the language, and they would actually, the first thing would happen, they would speak Russian to me. Mm-hmm. I was able to identify because I did 2 years of Russian at university back in the day. So, but this very much changed, right? I mean, so if you would
go today.
That would not happen, I think, to the same extent anymore.
Now, yes, and even, you know, I'm sorry to interrupt you, even when it comes to nationwide public opinion polls now, probably not all the people are still really regularly using Ukrainian language everywhere in the country, but this is 80% who say that they consider Ukrainian to be their mother language, their native language, though this is obvious that not 80% was speaking Ukrainian from the very childhood. So this is very reaction. These numbers will change, but this is something which is really a kind of protest against occupation and against invasion.
Yeah, I think what's really happening is, as you say, right? I mean, like it's this kind of, you know, civic identity which has really kind of become more prominent for and more salient for people, and you have seen this kind of alignment, right? I mean, between that civic identity and then the more kind of cultural kind of language-based identity, and people obviously kind of not wanting to speak the language of the occupier mm-hmm. In this kind of sense, I think. One other point you mentioned that I was quite interested in was on your last slide, right, when you talked about some of the complications, really, of also like of serving people in mm-hmm. obviously, you know, in wartime, you know, under occupation. What you've seen is, of course, huge internal displacement from those regions to other regions in Ukraine which are not occupied. You've obviously people have been refugees. Then you've also seen you mentioned the kind of large scale destruction that we have seen in Avika and Adrika, and also kind of obviously in other parts of Donbas. So my question to you is very much, and then the Russian Federation obviously also kind of trying to create facts on the ground, really kind mm-hmm. of like moving people, you know, like or incentivizing people to move from Russia into the occupied territories. So what do you mean? What do you think that means for the future, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, so for instance, you say, you know, it's a myth, right? I mean, that these regions cannot be kind of really united, mm-hmm. But still, you know, like the Russian Federation is trying to actually create this kind of situation on the ground right now as we speak, pretty much.
Yes, they are really doing this. They started from Crimea, where the substitution and replacement of the local population or fueling the local population with additional hundreds of thousands or dozens of thousands of, but actually hundreds of thousands, according to estimations, of Russian citizens. So they started it there, and they are now using this scheme, not that massively, but to use in unoccupied territories on the continental part of Ukraine, in Kherson, Zaporizhia, in Donetsk, and in Luhansk. When speaking about Donetsk region, this will create a problem, but I am more concerned now not about Russian citizens coming and staying, because there are cases, they are coming like a reconstruction teams to the cities which were almost wiped out, like Mariupol, from the surface of the earth, and now they are delivering reconstruction. And for this reason, they are not hiring local population, but sending the reconstruction teams from Rostov, Volgograd, and many other Russian cities. To many of them, even devastated Donbas looks like very attractive place of living. For instance, Mariupol is on the coast of the Azov Sea. And yeah.
Can I interject? I know this slightly takes us away from the public opinion service, but since you mentioned reconstruction, I was wondering, do you have any information on how well the sanctions regime has been able to incorporate those kinds of civilian construction companies, for instance? Because I heard of, you know, through and I'm from originally from Uzbekistan and Russia, as you know, I have contacts there, and I've heard of individuals working for companies, for instance, in the Russian region of Samara, that are involved in reconstruction of Mariupol. And it instantly, the question for me was how much the sanctions regimes in the West are actually encompassing those companies rather than just targeting the very straightforward, you know, military companies in the military industrial complex.
I don't have a data whether they are targeting basically such types of the companies, but if not, they will do, because before 2022, for instance, Russia didn't dare to finance regimes in Donetsk and in Luhansk region from important corporations or from important companies. For that reason, they were previously, so they were afraid of sanctions before 2022. For that reason, they created the special funds in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, which are another Russia-occupied territories, but of Georgia territories. And those funds, so Russia gives money to those funds in South Ossetia, and those funds actually finance the national, so-called national budgets of DPR and LPR. I'm not really sure about whether those companies participating in so-called reconstruction now of devastated cities are already on the list, but if they are not, they will be there, because maybe they will not be interested in that, because that's a big market for absorbing money from national budget of Russian Federation. There is no control, nothing, and they are doing that. So, but if not yet there, they will be there, because sanctions, as you might understand, is something long-lasting process which acquires different colors and forms. And going back to the Florian question, I'm more concerned now not of fueling or infiltrating the local population with Russian citizens. I'm more concerned with the space which is created for them there, namely in Donetsk and in Luhansk region, by drafting Ukrainian men on occupied territories and sending them to the front line. This is a tragedy, and this is mass tragedy, because conscription of Ukrainian citizens on occupied territory started even earlier than in Russia. In Russia, the general mobilization was announced in September 2022 after regular army actually failed this blitzkrieg strategy. But it started on 19th of February, 5 days before large-scale invasion in Donetsk and in Luhansk. And there are a lot different estimations, but it seems that it's closer to 100,000 of people who were already conscripted to the army. So generally, occupied part of the Donbas had about 3 million of population before 2022. And they are just conscripting people. They are sending them to the army. they were not drafting, I mean, Russians were not drafting anyone, almost anyone, not massively on the territories in Luhansk region, which were occupied in 2022, but several weeks ago, they actually started drafting there. And I am more concerned about that. So Russian citizens are not coming to nowhere. They're coming to not just add to the picture of local population, they are substituting. And this is a big problem, yes. But Ukrainian officials are very diplomatic when answering the questions what to do. Now this refers mainly to Crimea, what to do with people who came there after 2014, how to treat them, and what Ukraine will do that, will do with the population. Ukrainian officials are very accurate and they are very, you know, diplomatic, saying that we will develop a legislation, but I will say straightforwardly, in case or when Ukraine is controlling the territories which are, which have the Russian citizens in there, there will be changes to legislation, and these people will be just expelled to the country of their citizenship. So if they don't have a residence permit, they are basically violating the migration law, like in any other European country, and you will not just tolerate this. And that's why Russia is doing this on purpose now, in order to play this card once there will be negotiations about Crimea or any other occupied territories, to be present there even in case Russian authorities will leave the territory somewhere.
Great, thank you, Maria. I think we should hand it over to the audience.
Yes, I think we should open up to Q&A. I wanted to make sure we have at least 10 minutes of questions from the audience. I see some hands already. We'll start with you. If you could also introduce yourself, please.
Peter Wilson, Department of International Relations. Fabulous talk, really informative. Thank you very much, and very lucid too. I've learned so much. I wondered if you could say something about how these myths are being propagated and who holds them. Are you primarily referring to the Russian population or the Ukrainian population or the near abroad or Western European population that hold these myths or elites? I'm a little bit fuzzy on that.
Yeah, so basically there was, when it comes to these specific myths, there was not that much difference between how Russia is selling this to the external audience and to the domestic audience. But mainly, my main goal was to focus on something which is still circulating abroad in Western academia and in Western media and in Western expert calls as well. Because situation, for instance, in some global South countries or regions is completely much more complicated and completely different to a certain extent, but when it comes to this very basic idea that Donbas is a separatist region, there is no difference whether Russian official TV channels are communicating this to their domestic audience, because this is how they tried to persuade the domestic population that these territories under the Ukraine's attack, and there is a genocide. There is some Banderovtsi nationalists, and that's why we must recognize. First, they decided to recognize these territories 2 days before the invasion, and then so they were preparing the domestic population to the large-scale war, which actually happened as a result. And they were selling the same message to the West, and that is why actually there were long-lasting and unsuccessful talks, because Russia denied to name themselves. They were the party of the negotiations, but they denied to act like a party of negotiations and of somebody responsible for the decision making. And that was partially one of the reasons of failure of those talks, exactly because if you're talking to Russia, which Ukraine did, but Russia is not taking any responsibility for the implementation of even the documents which were signed by Putin in Normandy format, but say that these guys will be responsible for that. We don't control them. So this is how this myth was sold to the Western audience as well, and to decision makers, to expert communities. So I would say my initial idea was to catch up something which is still present in the West somehow, even in very, progressive and environments. But really, when you asked me this question, I realized that to domestic audience, Russia sold these myths in absolutely the same way, more aggressively, but the core content was the same.
Thank you. Any more questions? Eden.
Thank you very much. So I think your presentation obviously makes it very clear that the myths of overwhelming or majority preferences for independence in Donbass or union with Russia are incorrect. But if I'm not incorrect, one of the slides said that it was 23% of people in Donbass favored integration with or union with Russia, and an 18% favored increased autonomy. And to me, this sounds like still a significant amount of people unhappy, at least with the status quo.
It was a question. There were not the optional answer for the one question. It was like it was yes or no to every option. So it was not 18 plus 26 or plus something, you know. It was just, do you want? So there was the same people, what I'm trying to say. So not 26 plus 18 plus 18, and altogether they are not pro-Ukrainian. So this was about like, do you support any of these ideas, yes or no? And then all those ideas were tested separately. That's why we tested almost everything and find out that the largest share of population with so to say separatist intentions was 26% who supported the idea of possible joining Russian Federation by their region. But ideas of independence or anything like that were supported even less. So basically this is 26 was at least in spring 2014, it was the highest number of, let's say, pro-Russian population supporting pro-Russian political future. So.
Okay, could I ask? Even with those numbers, those corrected numbers,
yes, yeah.
Do you think that still would have been enough of a unhappiness with the pre-2014 status quo for it to be an issue, even if Russia had not invaded?
Do you mean if? Can you explain? So, would be enough it for? Which period of time, like if territories were not occupied or were not occupied in 2014?
Yes.
I would say that the main, that would not be enough for anything, and that was not enough for anything destabilizing the country from inside. So one of the important features of the public opinion on the ground was not being anti-Ukrainian when it comes to these 20 or 26% of people with really separatist intentions in spring 2014. The main problem was that entire population in Donetsk and in Luhansk region was much less active politically and in terms of civic activity than in many other regions of Ukraine. It means that even if you have like absolute majority of pro-Ukrainian population, but they are under threat or they are not feeling comfortable to, you know, to protest openly, gathering like hundreds of thousands of people. But you will see this minority, which in March and in April was very aggressive and was supported by Russian infiltration group and worse Russian infiltration group, basically. So I know the region from inside, and to me, the main idea of those people were that simply even those like 25% who were willing the joining the Russian Federation, for instance, they didn't have as a group enough activeness or agency to deliver this to any significant result, to bring it to any significant result. And that's why it was like negotiations or just talks, and everything could be easily solved if not some kind of altercation. So how can you handle any talks if militaries from other country without insignia but still armed and everything with FSB leader on their top are just coming, occupying administration building in the city and saying, this is now Donetsk People's Republic. I was in Slavyansk in April 2014 with my professor at the university. Tamila knows him, Oleksiy Harany. We were in Donetsk when there was already the building, the regional administration was occupied. We went to pro-Ukrainian meeting, which was guarded by police on the ground because aggressive people, we even don't know who were they, locals or not locals, because border was not that much under the control at that time already. So they were just wandering and waiting for the end of the pro-Ukrainian meeting to beat and to capture and to find people. So police was guarding people who were brave enough to protest in support of Ukraine and against any separatist scenario. But after that, my professor Harany said that he wanted to go to Slavyansk, which was already occupied by Yirkin and his people. And he said that he was afraid to do it on his own because he's alone and he's not from the region. I said, okay, so I want to go as well, but I'm also afraid to go. So let's go together. So we came there. It was really frightening, really frightening. So I'm from, my family are officers. I know how officers and people serving in the army looks like. So if they just take out the insignia, it changes nothing. So you see how they behave with the weapons, you see how they stand, how they react to everything going outside. So this was really very professional people claiming that they are local activists. And you can't prove this with any public opinion polls, but fortunately for Ukraine, some kind of investigation and data was gathered. And even in the documents of the International Criminal Court, this is said that Russian regular forces were participating in Donbas, starting at least from August 2014. But the European Court for Human Rights accused Russia of controlling the region starting from 11th of May 2014, when officially so-called referendum was done. So I don't see any chance, and at that time I also didn't see any chance for those 25% or 26%, even 30 if there were 30%, to do anything or to change anything in terms of status of the region, unless there was the Russian hand there.
Can I just add, and just also picking up on both of these questions as well, you mentioned Russia selling a particular kind of narrative. I think that's quite softly put, because I've studied Russian propaganda and media manipulation in quite systematically. We know that from the beginning of the Euromaidan, and really maybe a few weeks after, sort of with the start of 2014 already, there was a massive media effort, which means particular narratives were being projected in state-controlled pro-Kremlin media into different outlets and reproduced over and over and over again, preparing the public opinion in the way that you described. So there was a really massive effort to influence public opinion well before those, actually the, you mentioned hybrid warfare, well before they went in and these proxy forces began occupying administrative buildings. So there was already that, a combination of force and manipulation of public opinion, which was bound to have an influence on also somewhat on the survey responses, because there was an effort to scare the population into believing that their best choice is to join Russia.
One last point in this regard is that diversity which I spoke about, it also referred to the so-called separatist moods. Because, for instance, if you went to my home district, which was Stanitsa Luhanska district, you could probably people with separatist moods, which constitute those 26%. More often, then you go to the middle or north part of Luhansk region, where if you would ever say something, you would be just expelled of everywhere. If you say something in support of Russian occupation or separatist scenario. And this is how basically the so-called referenda looked like on 11th of May in 2014. There were no polling stations, there was nothing. So basically they were coming on the motorcycles from Luhansk to let's say, Starobilsk. Very good example was there. They were coming to the center of the city, putting a tent and saying that this is the voting, this is the box, and you should come and vote for independence of this republic. And in 1 hour after that, the local citizens, which were much more active, pro-Ukrainian one, they just said, go quietly out of the city. We are not moving to any republic, nothing. So there will be a disaster now, just move out of here. While in other towns, it was easier to organize because there were some locals who tolerated that. So even those 26%, you can't even say that, you know, they were equally widespread because they were not.
Thank you. I think we've run out of time, so I don't think we have time to get this side of the audience to ask further questions, but
you are welcome to come over, come up later, or
sure,
contact
yes,
me,
continue these
or come
questions.
To our next event, which will be on 13th of March, again at 6 p.m. Right, Katie? Yeah, it's also 6 p.m. and in the same rule. There will be not my presentation, it will be panel discussion on the main aspects of Russian invasion 2 years after the beginning of large-scale invasion. We will speak about Black Sea security, international dimension, informational warfare. So in 2 weeks from now, you are very welcome to come.
Thank you very much, and please join me in thanking.
Thank you for cheering. Thank you for cheering. Thank you for good questions, Florian.
And for your good questions. Thank you.